I'm Todd Gleason. This is WILL AM 580, a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here at the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Joined in studio by my cohort each and every day of the business week, Dave Dickey, the Director of Agricultural Programming, joining us for the closing market report this afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Dave. Glad to have you on board with us to talk a little bit about agricultural policy today.
And World Trade Organization policy as well, Todd.
You bet. This is one in a series of, either six or seven. We haven't quite decided. I think we're going to go one extra one in May. We thought we'd do six, but we think we probably need to do seven of these to get farmers and others interested in farm policy primed for the debate that's coming up for the 2007 Farm Bill. It's a wide-ranging farm bill. We'll take up all kinds of things from conservation in the future, ag policy from the left, ag policy from the right, those pertaining both to direct and countercyclical payments. We'll do food and nutrition programming next week, and we'll probably do ag policy from just left of center. There's one organization out there, the National Farmers Union, that we haven't talked to, but they play a fairly important role in Washington these days, and we need to take that up with them as well. Today in studio with us, Bob Thompson, Gardner Chair for Agricultural Policy here at the University of Illinois, former dean of the Agricultural College at Purdue University. After that, he worked with the Winrock Foundation, providing some leadership on international and agricultural issues, including renewable energy and resource issues. And then before coming back here to Illinois, spent some time taking up agricultural issues at the World Bank. Bob, thanks for joining us today. Also, one other thing in your background, you worked with USDA, I believe, as an undersecretary at one point, too.
Yeah, I was Assistant Secretary of Agriculture for Economics in the mid-'80s, during the 85 Farm Bill.
We will open up the phone lines now for your questions. We'd like to stick to just one topic today, the World Trade Organization. Let me give you the phone number so you can get in queue if you want to ask Bob some questions about this organization that seems to have so much sway over trade across the nation. The numbers are 800-222-9455. That's if you want to call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, or 217 locally, 333-9455. That 9455, by the way, spells out WILL. So it's 222-WILL or 333-WILL. Give us a call if you'd like to talk with Bob Thompson about the WTO. Bob, you and I were talking before we came on the air a little bit about some of the history of this organization. Oftentimes we refer to it as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, but it really came out of something that started long before we can think of that, maybe back in the 80s, maybe even as far back as the 70s. Where did the WTO come from, and how did it evolve over time?
Well, actually, the idea for the WTO goes all the way back to the waning years of World War II. We know that one of the reasons that the Depression went as deep as it did and lasted as long as it did was the cycle of rising protectionism in the world, and it really became a free-for-all out there and probably precipitated the bringing on World War II, or at least created the conditions where that was possible. So after the war, there was a sense that we really needed to do something to get some discipline in world markets, to rein in this free-for-all that was out there, to have some rules of the road that everybody agreed that they would follow. And so it was proposed already back then to create an international trade organization. But for various reasons, it was stillborn. But the reason for establishing some rules of the road had not gone away, and so a treaty was negotiated among the large economies of the world in which they agreed to what could and couldn't be done in trade, and they called it the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or the GATT. And we had about 10 rounds of negotiations among the members of the GATT, which gradually liberalized trade in most markets other than agriculture up until the last round. And the Uruguay round was the first time that we really made concrete and visible progress on agriculture. We didn't come anything close to free trade, of course, but we did make some good progress. And also out of that round, the ITO, which was stillborn in 1946, in effect came into being as the World Trade Organization.
You know, you've said this twice, in 46, that the ITO, the International Trade Organization, was stillborn. Interestingly enough, it was U.S. agriculture that probably caused that?
That's absolutely right. We had Section 22 in the then-existing ag legislation, which allowed the U.S. to put import quotas on imports of products that were which had price support programs, like dairy and sugar, both had Section 22 import quotas. There was a fear that if we opened up freer trade in all commodities, that agriculture would lose these price supports way back then in 1946. And as a result, American agriculture effectively blocked the creation of the ITO, prevented its passage by the Senate, and also when the GATT was negotiated, ensured that agriculture got exempted from most of the trade liberalization measures that were in it. Strange how things come full circle, that American agriculture was in the leadership and the vanguard pushing for freer markets in the Uruguay round.
That is kind of odd, because if you think about it, in this case, U.S. agriculture was extraordinarily protectionistic to the point that it killed the International Trade mm-hmm. Organization before it could actually be born. And then sometime in the early 90s and then in 96 when we finally got freedom to farm, which really changed how the Farm Bill was structured, free trade became the moniker for much of U.S. agriculture. And prior to that, if you think back, I suppose if we think back to maybe 1983, where we had payment in kind and we were putting whole farms, setting whole farm set-asides, and then in 85 had still some set-asides that were available. In 90, they talked about freedom to farm. They used the word, I think, decoupling back then, and even the Farm Bureau at that point was opposed to those kinds of things. But I don't want to digress too far into that Farm Bill debate just yet. Let's talk more about the World Trade Organization and the kind of sway today that it holds over not over the only the United States, but over the European Union, Australia, Brazil, and in particular, if you could tell us about the cotton decision that came about fairly recently, what that means, how it happened, and what it might mean for the future debate of the Farm Bill here in the U.S.
There is a lot of misinformation out around on what the WTO is and what it isn't, what it can and can't do. So I appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit of background on it. The first and most important thing is that WTO is a voluntary association of a group of countries which have agreed to meet periodically to review and update the rules of the road for international trade. At the moment, there are 148 members of the WTO. This is significantly more than when we did the Uruguay round negotiations, but more and more countries of the world see benefit from being affiliated with the WTO. So basically, the WTO does two things. It has a very small core staff in Geneva, which hosts these so-called rounds of trade negotiations that that review and update the rules of the road for international trade. Then, after those are agreed to, signed into law in the respective countries, then there is a capacity for reviewing and whether or not a country is violating or honoring these agreements. And in this case, Brazil brought a case against the United States alleging that the United States cotton program was not consistent with the Uruguay Round Agreement on agricultural trade. Now, we do need to keep in mind that it was basically the United States and the European Union which together wrote the Uruguay Round Agreement. In fact, they did it behind closed doors across the street from the White House in the Blair House in Washington, D.C. So we have to say, if we don't like the current rules of the road, we wrote them. And we need to acknowledge that. And if we don't like them, we need to negotiate possible changes in the future. So, okay, there's this dispute settlement capacity that the WTO hosts where they bring in three disinterested parties to review the allegations and evaluate whether they are or not consistent with the last trade agreement. The panel that did this evaluation found in Brazil's favor this last year in the cotton case. Then there's an appeal process, which is the appellate body, as they call it, is really the Supreme Court of world agricultural trade. It's made up of distinguished trade lawyers from all over the world who sit, in effect, as judges if one party or the other, or both, as in this case, appeal the decision of the dispute settlement panel. Okay, what did Brazil allege? Brazil alleged that that particularly the marketing loans, together with the loan deficiency payments and the countervailing payments, stimulated more cotton production in the United States than would otherwise have occurred, and that there are explicit export subsidy components of the cotton program embedded in the so-called Step 2 part of the program, which subsidize that larger production out into the world market, driving down the world market price. Now, the World Bank has estimated that the world cotton price is somewhere in the range of 20 to 40% lower today than it would have been in the absence of the high-income country subsidies and export subsidies to cotton, which is completely consistent with what the WTO found. The panel found in Brazil's favor on these terms. Brazil alleged that certain other parts of the cotton program were not consistent with the WTO rules, and the panel found in the United States' favor in those. For example, the direct payments were not viewed or were concluded to be not trade distorting. But the bottom line here is if the world market price of cotton was depressed below where it otherwise would be, that's the price that Brazilian cotton growers receive. It's the price that that African cotton growers receive. And basically, it's dirty pool if we drive down the price which is the entire compensation other countries' farmers get when we receive that price plus a whole lot of government subsidies on top of it.
If you'd like to join our conversation, please do. Phone lines are open. The number is 800-222-9455. That's toll-free, or locally you can call us at 217-333-9455. Give us a call, and you can join our conversation. We're talking with Bob Thompson, the Gardner Chair of Agricultural Policy here at the University of Illinois in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. He, along with Dave Dickey, is in studio with us this afternoon to take up the issue of the World Trade Organization. Right, Dave?
That's correct. And, Bob, I was wondering, what is the implication of this WTO ruling against the U.S. cotton industry in regards to other U.S. row crops?
That's an important point. And the implication is the fact that marketing loans, deficiency payments, or loan deficiency payments and countercyclical payments are all part of the soybean program, the corn program, as well as the programs for many other commodities. And whereas Brazil did not bring the case specifically with respect to those commodities, we are in the process of writing a new farm bill. And these things are going to need to be changed in the cotton program and are likely to be changed in everything else at the same time. Now, it's useful to remind ourselves that the WTO can't make any one country do anything. However, if the U.S. refuses to fix the things that were found to be in violation, then Brazil has the right to impose taxes on imports of U.S. products from any part of the U.S. economy to generate compensation for the losses that Brazilian cotton growers suffered as a result of the U.S. policies that were inconsistent with the WTO. So while we're writing the next farm bill and deciding what changes are going to be made in the cotton program, I think we can bet money that the same changes will be made in Midwestern commodities too.
But it's tricky because market factors have something to say about what is inside the amber box and what's outside the amber box.
Yeah, the so-called amber box is made up of the policies where the payments are linked at least somewhat to the production of specific commodities. The whole idea of this green box, amber box distinction is that every country is going to provide subsidies to their farmers at various points in time. It may be a case of disaster. It may be investments in agricultural research or rural roads. But every country's government subsidizes agriculture somehow. And the idea here is that those payments should not be linked to the production of any specific commodity. but rather should be made either as direct payments or in something that benefits all farmers in sort of in the form of public goods investments by the government, like ag research.
So you've said when this ruling came out from the appellate court that this would have a profound impact in changing the landscape for the Farm Bill in 2006-2007. How do you see that playing out? Will counter-cyclical payments be gone? Will LDPs be gone and replaced by conservation programs? What do you expect, and the thinkers that you're talking to in the policy issue expect to happen because of the WTO ruling as we move into the Farm Bill debate?
Let me preface my response by reminding everybody of the political clout of U.S. farm organizations, and none less than the cotton and rice growers, who are the most subsidized parts of American agriculture. It appears, based on the news of the last couple of days, that they've succeeded in getting cuts in the 2002 farm program benefits taken off the table in addressing the budget deficit reduction this year. And that's just a reflection of their political clout. That said, to the extent that Congress does make changes in our fundamental characteristics of our farm program, both because of the WTO cotton decision and the need to reduce the budget deficit, I think marketing loans, loan deficiency payments, and countercyclical payments are at the head of the list for certainly cuts and more likely complete elimination. That doesn't mean that all that money would be taken away. Some would be credited against deficit reduction. But more likely, there would be a shift of money out of those programs into either direct payments, conservation measures, or maybe even some kind of gross revenue insurance scheme. Canadians have experimented a lot with income insurance approaches to agricultural policy over the years. There was an experimental program put into the 2002 Farm Bill for fruits and vegetables and other commodities that don't have regular farm programs, and that's being talked about by a number of organizations. The Europeans want to put more of their money into conservation, so it'd be an easy deal to strike with the Europeans that we shift money out of commodity programs linked to specific commodities and into a more generic program such as conservation. And let's face it, all farmers like to get paid for doing something. They don't want to perceive that they're on the dole when they receive their direct payments from the government. And therefore, I think that does have merit. And we all know that farming is one of the most risky businesses. And as a result, perhaps some kind of gross revenue assurance scheme could have some virtue as well. I know some organizations are looking at it.
If you'd like to join our conversation, please do so. The number to call is 800-222-9455. That's toll-free. If you want, you're in the local area, you can call us at 217-333-9455. The 9455 obviously stands for WIL. I'll just pick up the cell phone and give us a call. We'd be more than appreciative to take your phone calls for Bob Thompson, who's the policy expert here at the University of Illinois. We're talking about the WTO. Who, Bob, are the members of the WTO and who are not?
Okay. There are just over 200 countries in the world today, and 148 of them are now members of the WTO. There are only a few big countries which are not members yet, and virtually everybody who matters in world trade is in the process of negotiating membership. China became a member at the Doha ministerial meeting, which kicked off this round, which is why it's called the Doha Round. I happened to be in the room at that historic moment to observe the Chinese entrance into the WTO, which was quite an experience to be part of that when I was there representing the World Bank at the at that meeting. Russia is the biggest country that's not yet a member of the WTO, which needs to be. When you're talking about rules of the road of international trade, whether it governs countries' behavior as an exporter, like saying that you can't subsidize exports, or countries' behavior as an importer, all the big players need to be in the organization and not outside. And Russia is moving pretty far along in its negotiations, and it shouldn't surprise anybody if it would be inducted as a formal member at the next time. Most of the countries of the world are now members. But the first time they had a GATT meeting, it was only 20 or 30 countries. It was just the big boys, the big economic powers of the world. None of the communist countries, none of the third world countries were part of it then. One of the big political changes in the WTO since the Uruguay Round Agreement is the majority of the members, as a result of the new entrants, are now developing countries. That's also one of the reasons that this is called the Doha Development Round or Doha Development Agenda, because if the developing countries don't perceive there to be something of value in it for them, there isn't going to be an agreement.
How do they get value out of an organization like this? When you have countries, China, who has billions of people, the United States, who has billions of dollars, the European Union in that same realm, how do countries that are developing take advantage of the WTO, and what impact do they have on world trade?
Well, first, every country is created equal in the eyes of the WTO. And in that sense, the smallest country in the world, the poorest country in the world, can bring a case against the richest country in the world or the biggest and most powerful country. The panel that evaluates the merits of their allegation will be made up of trade experts, both lawyers as well as economists, from countries that have nothing to do with either party, from other parts of the world. And so there is an objective third-party evaluation of whether the allegation of that little country that brings the case against the big boy, sort of David and Goliath, it puts David and Goliath on more even keel. But probably more important, trade is the most powerful engine of growth in the world. Foreign aid isn't the answer. Foreign aid is like international welfare. If a country is on foreign aid perpetually, it's on the dole. It's like a welfare check coming. Now, if the country is smart or is wise and uses this as an investment in things like infrastructure, education, gaining know-how, the country can benefit a lot. But if it's just squandered, or worse yet, gets put into Swiss numbered accounts of the president, foreign aid has its real limitations. Exporting gives a country the ability to pay its own way in the world. And the trade negotiations are supposed to open up markets so that each country can sell the goods that it produces more efficiently to other countries, which in turn buy it from them. Now, it turns out that in the presently low-income countries of the world, labor-intensive manufactured products like textiles and footwear are probably where their biggest comparative advantage resides. And in agriculture, it's sugar. The humid tropics have a big comparative advantage in cane production over beet producers in any temperate climate like the United States or Western Europe, and cotton and rice. The humid tropics certainly have the comparative advantage in rice production over California, where you're using highly subsidized water.
We have a caller on line 4 joining us now. Do you have a question for Bob Thompson, caller?
I do. I basically more though have a comment.
Okay.
I've been listening, and I appreciate your comments and your expertise. However, agriculture is such an intricate thing worldwide. Everybody wants to protect their own producers, and I don't like necessarily picking up that government check every year. However, I didn't make the choice 20 years ago when we embargoed grain and decided who we could and who we couldn't sell to, and in the process put South America in the soybean business. And if they were really hurting, I can't understand why they keep growing and planting 15% to 20% more every year. And one other comment: if we're going to have a level playing field, let's include them in as far as these patent situations on tech fees on their herbicides and whatnot. The local people that are selling us insecticides and herbicides in this country will turn right around in South America and turn around and sell them to them cheaper. So if we're going to have a level playing field, it needs to be level on all inputs, and I'll hang up and listen.
That's an interesting comment, especially on the tech fees. Mm-hmm. We know, of course, that companies like DuPont, Monsanto are selling BT corn, Roundup Ready products into Brazil, other parts of the world, are not collecting or capable of collecting tech fees in those areas. How does all that play into world trade?
This is an extremely important point. I agree completely with you that if the playing field is level for one, it's got to be level for all. Just one comment, though, on the Brazilian soybean expansion. I agree completely with you on the adverse impact of embargoes on the United States' credibility as a reliable supplier. And in fact, one of the issues that's being discussed in this round of trade negotiations is the rights of importers. If an importer is going to put part of its food security onto the world market and say, year in and year out, we're going to import 30% of our food supply, they've got to have assurance of access supply through good years and bad, that if the Europe has a drought or we have a political problem, we don't say you can't have it this year. There's got to be guaranteed access to supply if a country's going to do that. Otherwise, they're not going to they're not going to subject their people's food security to the vagaries of international markets and international politics. Now on the Brazilian soybean expansion, I think one can argue that the embargoes gave it a little bit of a boost, but virtually all of the enabling activity that created the expansion in Brazil was investments by the Brazilian government in tropical soils research and in soybean varietal development. I worked in Brazil for a couple of years teaching in 1972 and 73. When we drove out through that area, which is horizon to horizon soybeans today, it was twisted, gnarled trees, scrub vegetation, pathetic looking land that you'd say never could be used in agriculture at all. But Brazil's investments in breeding soybeans that are adapted for those conditions and learning how to manage that very difficult soil resource, that really created the possibility for the huge expansion. Soybeans were limited to the southern four states in Brazil through the embargo time and up until this research results came back. Now, the tech fees, that's a very important point you raise. The U.S. Congress reduced the investments in publicly supported agriculture research in the late 70s and in effect told the private sector, go ahead, you do the research, and we'll give you the right to patent the results so that you can have a monopoly on the results for something around 20 years and earn all you can on it in the meantime, and that'll pay for your research, that present research as well as future research. And that's in effect what our Congress told the private sector to do. So if we don't like that result, we ought to lobby for more public investments in agriculture research rather than throwing the book at companies which did exactly what Congress asked them to do. Now, you're right, though, that the unfairness of charging tech fees to our producers and the Argentine and Brazilian producers getting off scot-free. Monsanto closed its office in Argentina, effectively throwing up its arms a year or two ago and just, in effect, saying we give up trying to collect fees here. Now, that's interesting since Argentina is the company where biotech crops have expanded at the most rapid rate. We have a larger fraction of our land in biotech crops, but the expansion occurred at a much faster rate in Argentina. The Roundup Ready beans in Brazil were all smuggled across the border from Argentina. The companies didn't sell them there. And I can tell you that the companies that sold them in Argentina intended to get paid the tech fees, but the financial crisis ended up thwarting that. Monsanto and the other companies, though, are negotiating right now with both the Brazilian and Argentine governments to try and find a way where either they can put a tax on beans at the time they're sold to the crushing plant or at the time of export, and that tax would compensate the companies that produced the biotech, like Roundup Ready beans.
just the anecdotal evidence that we've heard over the last 6 months, I think, out of Brazil, as we've been discussing soybean rust, tells us that the northern areas of Brazil, where you're talking about great expansion, generally speaking, do not plant Roundup Ready soybeans, and they do they plant determinant beans, and I assume that those were probably, and in fact I think we've been told by a couple of our scientists along the way that those were developed by the Brazilian government. So it was research and monies that the government there was pouring into agriculture that helped them to expand.
Absolutely. You had to breed the photoperiod sensitivity out of the soybeans so you could move them closer to the equator. You also had to breed in tolerance for aluminum, because there were huge aluminum toxicity problems up until that point. But it was very much Brazil's government investments that made the expansion possible.
Just one other comment. I was at ADM's Europort several years ago, 2002, and they happened to be importing Brazilian beans at the time. It was in May, and they opened up one of the crushing machines, and it was fairly obvious that these were not from the United States. These beans had a red, almost pinkish cast to them, which caused some problems, actually, for oil production, simply because they didn't want red oil coming out of these. Yeah. They needed them to be clear. It was kind of an interesting little tidbit. We've got just a few minutes left, maybe three and a half. If you're interested in talking to Bob very quickly, 800-222-9455 is the number. Toll free locally, 333-9455, about 4 minutes, maybe three, that you can get in and talk with Bob Thompson about the WTO. Bob, if you could wrap up for us your feeling about WTO's impact on, and I know you've discussed this once, but a short version, impact on the coming farm bill debate and what it will allow and will not allow the U.S. to have in the coming years in terms of direct payments, countercyclical payments, LDPs, loan deficiencies, those kinds of things.
Well, what the next WTO agreement will or will not allow the United States to do depends 100% on the negotiating success of the United States negotiators in Geneva and other venues, because we're not going to give things that unless we get access to other countries' markets for things that we produce more efficiently. So this is one of the reasons that we need to keep our eye on both of these processes at the same time, because we need to be negotiating aggressively in the WTO. At the same time, we're evaluating what changes to make in the 2002 Farm Bill. And on the third track, parallel, we've got the budget deficit reduction. And so there's going to be cross-fertilization among these all the time. Let me point out, though, that in the strict interpretation of the WTO cotton decision, the U.S. marketing loans, loan deficiency payments, and countercyclical payments are in violation of the last agreement. And in the strictest interpretation, we cannot get anything in the current round of negotiations in exchange for giving those up, because those are in violation. We were doing something in violation of the last agreement. That too will be part of the negotiations. Will the other countries give us credit?
You tell me that it looks like USTR will actually have a great deal to do with what happens with the Farm Bill. That, of course, out of the Bush administration, U.S. Trade Representative's office. I think Alan Johnson, probably one of the chief negotiators there. We talk about him on the air from time to time. How much pressure does he get from not only the Bush administration, but from organizations like the Farm Bureau and the National Farmers Union to take particular stances as he negotiates trade deals?
Well, the Department of Agriculture has formalized the so-called APAC and ATAX, which are citizens advisory groups representing these farm organizations, who help pull together the positions and advise the trade negotiators. If you're the U.S. trade negotiator, you've got the farm organizations looking over your shoulder all the time.
Bob, we appreciate you being with us today. And if people want to talk to you, they can give you a call at the university. Your number is?
333-1313.
1313, 1313, 333-1313. If you'd like to call and talk to Bob Thompson in person about agricultural policy, we sure do appreciate having you along for the day.
It's always good. Thanks a lot for having me, Todd.
Bob Thompson is the Gardner Chair of Agricultural Policy at the University of Illinois. Joined us on Ag Policy Radio as we take up Ag Policy Radio and look to the future of the Farm Bill here in the United States. You are listening to WILL Urbana. This is a broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. Thanks to Bob and Dave Dickey for joining us this afternoon.